From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Bethesda, Maryland.
And I'm Scott Tong in Arlington, Virginia. This is Here and Now. The group of Canadian protesters calling themselves the Freedom Convoy have gridlocked Ottawa for 2 weeks now. Yesterday, truckers blocked a border crossing between Alberta and Montana, as well as a bridge connecting Ontario to Detroit. This protest movement began in opposition to COVID restrictions, but it's been embraced by a variety of right-wing causes, and now it's spreading internationally. Kieran O'Connor tracks online extremism at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Kieran, welcome.
Hi, Scott.
So let's start in Canada. Polls say a large majority of Canadians support vaccine requirements, and yet this convoy has attracted so much attention and money. What do we know about who's supporting this and how the word's getting out?
Looking at Canada, what seems to be emerging now is that the people and the kind of groups at the forefront of the movement there come from anti-government, nationalist, and even anti-vaccine factions as well. And what's happened in the last few weeks is that this has kind of formed into a popular mass movement that had at the beginning kind of well-defined objective to do with border mandates, but it has grown. The protest movement has quickly morphed into a loose national and international coalition, bringing together various anti-government and anti-establishment causes, ranging from right-wing actors all the way towards more extremist white supremacist actors as well online.
Well, I want to ask you about this messaging that has taken this conversation global. There are efforts to spur protests south to the U.S., to Australia and New Zealand. There's a scheduled big convoy descending on Brussels in the EU next week. Is there something new and different going on here, or more effectively communicated on social media?
I think what we're seeing in Canada, and especially the way that it's morphing internationally, is the latest iteration or even the culmination of COVID protest movement that has been developing over the last 2 years. And when we see this move internationally on the kind of crowdfunding campaign side of things, the campaign has received a lot of support from right-wing politicians and media figures and kind of influencers in the US, but it's also received a lot of support in Europe as well.
Now, you study online communication and social media. Is there evidence that messages on the political right or messages against COVID restrictions have a disproportionate amplifier?
Yeah, COVID-19 has served as a catalyst for radicalization in so many ways. It's allowed extremists to capitalize on the frustration and anger and anxiety of many people. And it's also allowed extremists to frame events of the last 2 years or the reaction and responses by governments in simplistic terms, in us versus them, good versus people, the pure people versus the corrupt elite. And at various instances in kind of COVID protest waves, be it around masks or opposition to lockdowns or even vaccines, we've seen extremists co-opt and capitalize on these kinds of frustrations and movements. What extremists are doing is that they are taking these events and they're using social media platforms to spread the message. And there's a risk of people who do have genuine, you know, frustrations or are simply just fed up with restrictions in whatever country they may be, of being radicalized in these spaces online. These extremist groups are skilled in using the networked infrastructure of social media platforms, but also in using the unique features of each platform that allow them to connect and spread their message beyond their nearest border.
Well, finally, I want to ask you about the potential risk of violence. Is there evidence that this kind of online discourse you're describing can lead to either planned or unplanned violence?
Absolutely. We're all very well aware of what happened in Washington, D.C. on January 6th last year, but that didn't happen in a vacuum. That was the culmination itself of months and years of extremist rhetoric, activists and groups on social media who were using social media platforms to seed, post, produce and refine where needed conspiracies and mis- and disinformation that were rooted in political claims. And now throughout COVID, we've seen this kind of switch towards claims about government overreach or claiming that restrictions are anti-democratic in nature and they represent a permanent power grab by the elites or they represent the erosion of civil liberties. So there is a danger in how this kind of rhetoric can inspire violence. And as we've seen in many different ways, in many different stories and events over the last few years, online actions have offline consequences. There is, of course, yes, a danger of violence leading from this, yes.
Yeah, offline consequences, as you say. Caroline O'Connor tracks online extremism at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Caroline, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, Gil.
It's been a swift fall from grace for President Biden's top science advisor. Eric Lander was sworn into office last June, but this week he resigned from his position as director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Lev Fasher has been reporting on the impact of Lander's resignation. He's Washington correspondent for STAT. Lev, welcome.
Thank you.
So why is Lander resigning?
Eric Lander is resigning after a White House investigation found that he acted in a verbally abusive manner pretty consistently in his role as director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. This investigation concluded back in December. It only came to light, though, this week after a Politico report. And within just a few days, Lander had announced his resignation. So, of course, a major blow to the Biden administration's scientific aspirations.
And in his resignation letter, Lander said, quote, "I am devastated that I caused hurt to past and present colleagues by the way in which I have spoken to them." And he added that the work of this office is far too important to be hindered. So let's talk about the work of his office. What exactly was his department? He's the first White House science advisor to hold a seat on the president's cabinet, which demonstrates how important his position was. What was he doing?
Exactly. He's also the first White House science advisor to come from a life sciences background. Typically, it's a job that's focused more on the physical sciences. The office was actually founded in response to the Cold War and the threat of a nuclear USSR. It's shifted, though, and particularly under President Biden, some of that office's biggest goals right now include the revamped White House Cancer Moonshot, as well as the creation of a new agency called ARPA-H, which is essentially DARPA for healthcare. It's this really high-stakes research agency essentially aimed at developing biomedical breakthroughs, and nothing like it has really existed on the healthcare front in the federal government before. So among others, those are two of the huge priorities that Eric Lander was working on, and their fate is now less clear than it was just a week ago.
One of the things that Eric Lander oversaw, at least in his department, his division, was the Cancer Moonshot Initiative. President Biden has talked about this quite a bit. He set a goal of cutting cancer deaths in half within the next 25 years. Here's a little bit of him laying out that vision.
Our message today is this: we can do this. I promise you, we can do this. For all those we lost, for all those we miss, we can end cancer as we know it.
So what impact does Eric Lander's resignation, his departure, have on the cancer moonshot effort?
You know, it's not yet clear. One of the big questions about the cancer moonshot was whether the White House was going to ask Congress for more money to fund it. And typically, when the White House makes that ask of lawmakers, they essentially send someone to Capitol Hill to lobby on behalf of that request. And that would have been Eric Lander. It might also have been Francis Collins, the former director of the National Institutes of Health. But he resigned in December, so that agency has a leadership vacancy as well. That said, there is really good leadership atop the Cancer Moonshot right now. Danielle Carnival is running that effort. She's a longtime Biden aide. She's a trained neuroscientist. She really has experience shepherding this kind of big project. So there's a degree to which that project might be insulated, but in terms of a really public face and someone who can go to Capitol Hill and make the case for more funding and for whatever other legislative language is needed to push that project forward, I think that's the big unresolved question in light of Lander's resignation.
Although there are questions about whether this kind of derails this effort that after the Biden administration had put so much behind not just Lander, but this entire initiative to increase science involvement in and what government can do with its funds. And I have to assume increase public trust in science. Does this damage the reputation of a department that the Biden administration was so concerned about polishing.
It's hard to see how it wouldn't. If you just zoom out a bit, President Biden campaigned on following the science, on listening to the doctors, especially in the context of COVID-19. But now here we are more than a year into his administration. You know, there are a lot of remaining questions about the administration's ability to really follow through on its pledge of being the science administration and, you know, President Biden's pledge to be the president who ends cancer as we know it.
That's Lev Fasher, Washington correspondent for the health and medicine publication Stat. Lev, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Celeste.
You'll find a link to Lev Fasher's article about Eric Lander on our website, hereandnow.org.
As Academy Awards season begins in earnest, The Power of the Dog leads the pack. Jane Campion's menacing take on masculinity in the American West got 12 nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. The film is set on a 1920s cattle ranch in Montana, and it's run by two brothers, George and Phil Burbank, played by Jesse Plemons and Benedict Cumberbatch.
Guess this is it.
What's it, Phil?
What's it? All right, Batso, I'll tell you what it is. 25 years since our first run together. 1900 and nothing.
That's a long time.
Well, not too damn long.
This is a place dominated by men. So what happens when George marries the widow Rose and brings his new bride home to live on the ranch? Well, brother Phil sets out to destroy her. Benedict Cumberbatch and Jesse Plemons are up for Oscars, as is Kirsten Dunst, who plays Rose. And the Oscars were very much on her mind when she talked to Peter O'Dowd in December, though Peter began by asking Kirsten Dunst what drew her to the role of Rose.
Well, the way it was written was there's a lot of room. You know, I like when there's room to, you know, have private moments with characters and really a lot to fill in emotionally, like for the screen, not just with words. So I was drawn to that, and I love whenever you see a woman start to lose it. It's fun to play, and it's fun to see. So it's nice to be ugly, you know, and show all that kind of stuff. I remember I had to, like, run out screaming, and everyone, even the horses, were like, whoa. It's fun to surprise people and scare people, and you know what I mean? It's just, you know, it's a perfect storm of, like, working with the best creatives. And then Johnny Greenwood's doing the score.
Yeah, you had mentioned so much is accomplished in so few words. Speaking of that, there was this scene where you're practicing the piano, and without saying a word, Phil comes in, and he just destroys Rose's confidence by playing the same tune she's struggling with on the banjo. Let's listen to that. Sounds cheerful when we're listening back to it, but really, it's not. It's a chilly moment in this film. Have you ever been in a movie where, like, so few words were needed to express such a feeling of menace and dread?
Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty good at that stuff. I'm like, you need an actress not to speak and show some things. Like, hire Kirsten. She's pretty good at that. So I wasn't worried about that. I was just like, what is the feeling for me, you know, to convey that best as Rose? And I was thinking, to be a creative and to, like, play the piano and to, you know, have something you feel confident in or that you're good at and practicing. And then you hear someone who actually has true artistry and true, and it's easy for them or it seems easy. I think for anybody who, in any job, I think that there's, like, a level that, like, you kind of keep wanting to reach. And I think if you, seeing someone else reach that can be really soul crushing.
Yeah. And I think it seems like Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays Phil, knew that feeling as well. And that's why that scene was so powerful. Is it right that the two of you, in order to prepare for this movie, you actually didn't speak on set?
No, we didn't talk to each other, which was helpful. It just set the tone and it's just like a good energy to have between us on set. And I think it influenced, like, the whole set, the way he acted. Like, he very much stayed in a zone of Phil. And I think that was helpful for everybody. And yeah, him and I, we don't really have much exchanges together in the
almost none.
It's like a word here or there, and it's me trying and then being shut down. So it was all about creating what that feeling is for Rose and how people can gaslight other people, whether in work or relationships or whatever it is. If your brain is vulnerable, people can really get in there and worm their way in and really psychologically damage someone.
Mm. I'm speaking with Kirsten Dunst about The Power of the Dog. And Kirsten, one of the central themes of this film, of course, is on masculinity. And this next clip is from a scene with your character, Rose, and her son, Peter, who's played by Cody Smit-McPhee. He wants to be a doctor, and he's just killed their pet rabbit so that he could dissect it. Let's listen to that.
I thought you liked rabbits.
Yes, I do. But if I want to be a surgeon, I have to practice.
Well, you're not to kill them in the house, Peter. No, I'm putting my foot down.
Well, where'd a man be if he always did what his mother told him?
This is a film about men and masculinity, as I said. What's your take on those themes? As one of the few women in the movie.
I know, I'm really them. I mean, it's such a big conversation. I think, you know, whatever fill that toxic kind of male energy, that comes from like so much pain, you know? But there's so many weird things. Like the opening of the movie, you see that George and Phil, like Jesse's character and Benedict's character, they sleep in the same room together and they're like in their 30s. There's so many weird things happening that make someone act out in the way that Phil does. He's like a big baby that like is just a hurt crying child. It's just, that's a very easy thing to see from an outsider, but when you're in it with the people, that family dynamic is very ingrained. The whole relationship is very toxic.
You have two sons, I think, right?
Yeah. Is that, yes.
Yeah, and I think they're very young still, but what is all this talk that we're having about toxic masculinity in our society today? Like, does that make you think or worry about, like, what kind of men will you be able to raise your boys to be?
Well, I'm very lucky that I have an incredible partner. Jesse's a very kind man, and I just think you kind of learn from example. And also, all you can do is love your kids, you know what I mean? Like, you can't, I will influence them as best as I can, you know, raise them maybe not in LA, raise them in Texas, you know, Austin, Texas, or like do whatever I can to not, for me, turn them into like kids of actors, you know what I mean? Just like this natural entitlement that just comes with like being in LA because we're such a one industry town. I mean, I have a friend, he was like at school, this other kid would be like, my dad didn't hire your mom for this job or whatever. It just sounds so awful to have that.
So it sounds like part of what you're saying is to make them better adults is to get them a heck out of LA, raise them differently.
I think so. Yeah. I think that's the goal, I think, is like not to raise any entitled brats. That's my concern. I mean, I just want to raise good humans. That's it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of family, we've heard you talking about Jesse. That is, of course, Jesse Plemons, who plays George in this film, your husband, also your partner in real life. Let's listen to one more scene between the two of you here when you're teaching George how to dance.
One, two, three, to the side. One, two, three, and back. One, two, three. Told you I'd teach you.
So an intimate moment there on screen, but also, again, what's it like to, I don't know, make a movie like this in particular with someone who you're so close to personally? Like, do you talk about the movie over dinner and stuff, or how does that work?
Jesse still has not seen the movie.
What?
It's crazy. I'm like, come on, let's just put it on. It's on Netflix now. Come on, man. Like, let's watch the movie. We can laugh together, whatever. We'll watch it like a home movie.
Why doesn't he watch
just,
it?
I think at this point, it's just, we will sit down and watch it, or he will eventually. But I understand, too, sometimes you make a movie and it feels like it almost feels like a little death when you watch it because you're like, oh, that's over with and that happened and I can't change it. I don't know. I find I enjoy everyone else's performances and then just really pick apart mine.
Mm, you feel self-conscious?
Not self-conscious. It's just like, oh, my voice or this or that. I just, it's hard not to critique yourself while you're watching. I mean, it's like recording your own answering machine. It's, we all do it. It's just...
No, I'm a radio guy. I can relate for sure.
And the other
thing is, like, it's this beautiful film, and it's over. You're right. It's over. But now I think the next chapter is, like, all this talk with, will it win an Academy Award? And is Kirsten Dunst going to get her first nomination? What do you think about that? Is that something that, like, excites you? Does it matter to you?
Listen, of course it'd be so, I mean, for my mom, my friends, my family, yeah, it would mean a lot, yes. It's just like one of those things when you're an actor, like one of your dreams in life is to win an Academy Award, you know what I mean? It's just part of it. I'd like to be cool and be like, no, I don't care, but obviously I'd love to be nominated.
Is it your best work? I mean, like, is this the film you think you should get a nomination for at this point?
Oh, wow. Now, well, listen, I can't be like, I shouldn't. Right. But I don't know. I think a lot of these things are just the perfect storm. I'm very lucky to be a part of a movie that's really good and everyone's really good in it and people are liking it.
You've been making movies for a long time, something like 30 years since you were a kid. Have your priorities changed over the years? Or is there like something else you want to do in Hollywood besides get your kids out of town, but like something else that you want to accomplish in the industry that you haven't?
I feel like this is just all so much more fun. I think that just comes with age. Like you just are more confident. You question yourself less. You give yourself permission to fail and all these things because it doesn't really matter. You know what I mean? It's just like, were you a good person? You know, I just want to have good experiences and like work with creative people that want to try and push things and make things that are exciting.
Kirsten Dunst stars in The Power of the Dog. Kirsten, thank you so much and congratulations on a beautiful film.
Thanks, Peter.
That's our interview from December. Kirsten Dunst did get nominated for an Oscar, as did Johnny Greenwood, who wrote the score. This is a little taste.
When President Biden recently reflected on his first year in office, he admitted one big tactical error.
The public doesn't want me to be the president's senator. They want me to be the president and let senators be senators.
In other words, Biden thought he spent too much time bogged down in negotiations. But then Biden got a chance to fill a seat on the Supreme Court. As NPR's Scott Detrow reports, it's an opportunity that has the president once again drawing on his long tenure in the Senate.
Biden sure sounded like a president senator when he recently sat down with Republican Chuck Grassley and Democrat Dick Durbin in the Oval Office to talk about the upcoming nomination.
We've done an awful lot of Supreme Court justice together, Senator Grassley and I, as well as Senator Durbin. And we've worked together in a lot of court nominations overall, but particularly Supreme Court nominees.
Biden even mentioned that he had recently spent time rereading his old opening statements from past confirmations. The same day, Biden called Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to talk about the nomination process. He's phoned Republican Senator Susan Collins, too. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says Biden isn't walking away from that promise to stay out of legislative details.
I think what he was referring to in those comments was hours and hours and hours of endless closed-door meetings as it related to negotiating through the course of the fall. But this is an opening on the Supreme Court, which is a lifetime appointment, something the president takes very seriously.
When Biden looks back at his time in the Senate, he often focuses on the bipartisanship. It's what he singled out about Justice Stephen Breyer's time as a Judiciary Committee lawyer.
He was famous for biking across Washington virtually every day for a face-to-face meeting with a Republican chief counsel, the ranking Republican counsel. And over breakfast, they discussed what would they do for the country together. Whereas in those days, we tried to do things together.
Not always, though. University of Georgia law professor Lori Ringhand has written extensively about these nominations.
The Supreme Court confirmation process has always been responsive to moments of intense partisanship. There's never really been a long period of time when this has not had at least some controversy around it.
Biden oversaw smooth bipartisan confirmations for justices like Breyer, but he also chaired some of the most contentious hearings in recent memory. The Clarence Thomas confirmation, rocked by Anita Hill's sexual harassment allegations. And the 1987 Robert Bork confirmation Biden helped scuttle by focusing on how Bork viewed privacy rights.
If they had evidence that a crime was being committed,
how are they going to get evidence that a couple are using
wiretap?
Wiretapping?
Wiretap.
Ringhan says three main factors go into how contentious a confirmation is. The overall political mood of the country, which party controls the Senate, and whether the new justice would flip the balance of the court. While partisanship feels like it's at an all-time high, in this case, Biden's pick wouldn't change the court's numbers. Given that, Brian Fallon doesn't see anything wrong with Biden spending time courting Republicans. That's despite the fact the executive director of Demand Justice has often criticized Democrats for not being sharp-elbowed enough on court confirmations.
There's a difference between, you know, the vast majority of the Republicans voting no on this pick and them going on total war footing on this nomination fight.
Fallon also sees Biden's Republican outreach as a way to soothe concerns of more moderate Democrats in an evenly divided Senate. That's always a critical task, as the Biden White House knows from all of last year's negotiating. Scott Detrow, NPR News, Washington.
Once the exercise darling of the pandemic, Peloton is in a bit of trouble. The company reported losing more than $400 million in its most recent quarter. And yesterday, it said it would lay off 2,800 workers. That's 20% of its workforce. Also on the chopping block, the CEO post and a factory in Ohio that was scheduled to open in 2023. Robin Farzad is here for more. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hello, Robin.
Hello, Celeste.
So things are not looking so great for Peloton, but I tend to wonder if the news of their demise is as breathless as the news that they were going to take over the world. How bad is their financial situation?
Celeste, this whole episode takes me back to the dulcet tones of Jermaine Jackson in 1984.
Oh, no.
Specifically where, give me a second, I was crazy for you, you were crazy for me, how could something so right go so wrong.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Other than the,
indeed,
the standard.
Everybody thought Peloton was going to take over the world, right?
Yeah.
The stock shot up well into 2020. It had a market cap of $50 billion. Management's thinking, gosh, we cannot sell enough of these things. We've become the new normal, to throw around the cliche. And then they overexpanded and indebted themselves into that. And when things snapped back and people started going to the gym and people realized that Peloton was not, in fact, going to take over the world of exercising, you have this enormous capital expenditure overhang.
Are they alone? Are there other companies that may be at risk if they boomed at the beginning of the pandemic and are now seeing slowing demand?
Well, you saw parallel to that the whole meme stock craze with kind of AMC and GameStop shares. Some people were romancing the idea that BlackBerry was going to make a comeback. We all had a lot of extra time on our hands. And if you're on kind of Reddit Wall Street Bets and you're, you know, throwing all these theories out there, then the sky's the limit when money is free and the stock market just keeps going up in such chunky terms every day. But at some point, when the financials come out and you see that these companies are very mortal, that management in this case was very fallible. You had a CEO who's been there for a decade who said, I don't even talk to the chief technology officer. You had activist investors kind of affix themselves to it and say, this situation is screwed up, that it's in fact kind of a very ordinary story in some respects.
So Peloton's chief executive and founder, John Foley, will step down. He'll become executive chairman instead. How much of the blame can be laid at his feet?
I mean, this was done with a management team and a board and the best information that they knew that they had. If everybody's suddenly giving your orders and saying, we need this stuff. I mean, I once had the CEO of Purell on my show, and she started within weeks of this pandemic. If you thought all of us were going to be using oceans and oceans of antibacterial gel, then you would expand accordingly into that. But that also mean reverted. So they did make a couple of ill-timed acquisitions. They spent $420 million buying this equipment maker Precor. They invested heavily in building out manufacturing. It spent another $400 million on a factory in Ohio. There was one theme park type affair. And sadly, they had this imbroglio with Sex in the City, where they were kind of ridiculed. And then their spokesperson, Christopher Noth, was then entangled in a sexual assault claim. So, you know, hit after miss after miss after miss after miss. And there's hope right now that new management and a shareholder activist can stabilize the story.
You're speaking to the moment on Sex and the City where Peloton possibly killed Mr. Big, although Peloton came out with an ad showing he was still alive, just didn't want to be with Carrie anymore. Are investors and shareholders responding to the bad news?
Well, look, it's not the end of the world. The company is still worth, what, $12 billion? That's down from a peak of $50 billion. But if you bought in at around the $50 billion level and thought that this was going to be, you know, the next, Apple, you're hurting in a major way right now. And your hope is that Amazon or Apple or somebody else takes this company out.
Yeah. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you as always, Robin.
I'm sorry for hurting your ears. Thank you.
Back to the office. A lot of businesses want workers to return as the Omicron wave seems to have passed, which means employees are facing that dreaded T word, T for traffic. But what if you could just rise above it all? Yeah, you know where we're going. From IEEE Spectrum, reporter Ari Daniel has our story.
To get where you want to go, imagine that instead of hopping in your car or taking a subway or a Lyft, you opt for an air taxi.
It takes off like a helicopter, flies like a plane, and it's super comfortable and it's piloted.
Bonnie Simi is head of air operations and people at Joby Aviation, based out of Santa Cruz, one of a handful of companies developing air taxis, or as insiders call it, electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, eVTOLs. The Joby aircraft seats four passengers and a pilot and flies just over 200 miles an hour. Imagine a sleek white helicopter body.
But forget that it's noisy, because our aircraft is not noisy at all. We're 100 times quieter than a helicopter.
Here it is in flight. The vehicle's got six propellers pointing upwards, which allow it to take off vertically. Then, once airborne, the propellers transition to a forward direction. Simi, a former airline pilot, hasn't flown an actual Joby air taxi, but she's spent plenty of time in the simulator.
It's a joy to fly. You can fly fast, you can fly slow. It's very, very simple to fly. Basically, point the aircraft where you want it to go and it goes.
Joby's air taxi is intended to be environmentally friendly, just like those of some of the other companies out there. Florian Reuter is CEO of Volocopter, based in southern Germany.
The vehicle is fully electrically powered, so if you charge the batteries renewably, you actually have a very sustainable means of transport.
Of course, that's a big if. An air taxi is fully sustainable only if it's plugged into an outlet that draws power from renewable sources. Volocopter has two designs, a two-seater with 18 rotors mounted to a circular overhead frame that can fly 22 miles on a single charge, and a four-seater with a mix of eight upward and forward-facing rotors that can fly up to 62 miles. Both can be flown by a pilot, remotely piloted, or operated autonomously. Compare that to the Joby aircraft that requires a pilot but can fly 150 miles on a single charge. Okay, so say you need to get from A to B. How would you use an air taxi exactly?
You're somewhere in the city, you have a transportation need.
Imagine opening up an app saying, I want a ride from my house to downtown. A ride-sharing service may show up, like an Uber, bring you to our aircraft.
Further down the road, we will be able to really pick you up in front of your door. But for the time being, you might as well walk or take an e-scooter, let's say, to the next takeoff and landing site near you. You are seamlessly digitally checked in with all the safety checks, the weight and balance checks.
We fly you to the city, to the top of your building, to a parking garage, to the local airport.
And you will make potentially the last mile on foot or with a different mode of transportation.
The companies say a trip of 10 to 25 miles or so might ultimately set you back $75 or $100. Better materials, batteries, and higher performing sensors and onboard computational capabilities have contributed to the imminent feasibility of air taxis, not to mention new regulations now in place that allow the certification of electric aircraft. Soonjo Chung is a professor of aerospace at Caltech.
We are going to have air taxis flying pretty soon in 5 years, 10 years.
But to soar in our skies, safety is paramount. Let's say you hit a bird.
For other aircraft or helicopters that suddenly leads to big damage and catastrophe. But for the air taxis, you have multiple propellers.
Multiple propellers mean less chance of failure. But there's also weather to contend with, software failures, emergency landing protocols. But both Joby and Volocopter say they're confident they can meet these challenges before they debut in 2024. Florian Reuter of Volocopter again.
We are now seeing capabilities that will ultimately lead to a massive transformation in the way that we move about this planet, because now we can fly where we needed to walk earlier.
And blissfully, there's little traffic up there, at least not until the skies fill with quiet flocks of air taxis. For Here and Now, I'm Ari Daniel.
$7.6 billion. That's how much gambling pros figure will be on the line for the Super Bowl on Sunday. By the way, the latest betting odds favor the Rams over the Bengals by 4 points. We have seen an explosion in sports gambling ever since a Supreme Court ruling in 2018 paved the way for states outside of Nevada to allow it. So now, 30 states and the District of Columbia now have some form of legal sports gambling, either in person, online, or by mobile device. Let's bring in Bloomberg Opinion columnist Tim O'Brien for more on this growing industry. Welcome, Tim.
Great to be here, Scott.
So tell us about this exploding growth ever since the Supreme Court ruling 4 years ago. I mean, how big is this?
It's massive, and it's both, I think, a confluence of the Supreme Court ruling and technology. And on the Supreme Court side, in 2018, the court essentially decided to overturn a 1992 law, a federal law, that prevented states from authorizing sports betting. This is consistent on a number of issues where the court is essentially getting the federal government or federal oversight out of a number of areas. And I think the theory behind it was the states know best. Let them look after their own affairs when it comes to gambling. That really opened the doors to a legitimate boom. But even before that ruling came along, the internet and mobile technology had already opened the doors to a sort of sub rosa culture of sports gambling that has now come rapidly and in a very massive kind of way into the open because the Supreme Court essentially blessed it all as legitimate.
Yeah. So Tim, help me help us understand how then this mobile technology works. So on Super Bowl Sunday, can I go to my phone and bet on, I don't know, whether this is going to be a run or a pass coming or who's going to make the tackle? I can bet on these little micro things happening in the course of the game?
In the trade, those are called prop bets, and you certainly can. You can also just do a plain old-fashioned who's going to win the game bet. Those bets have been around a long time. You used to only be able to make them legally in Las Vegas, although people, you know, forever found local bookies to do it illegally. And then there was, you know, just harmless office pools that accompanied all of that. Now there are apps for that. Some of the leading ones are DraftKings and FanDuel. Those are both companies that were offering fantasy sports games that were essentially, in my view, gambling in disguise before the Supreme Court legitimated all of this.
What's the risk here, Tim? The experts say gambling is a public health problem, right?
The risk is high. You know, it's interesting to put it in a bit of a historical perspective. There had always historically been a kind of moral opposition to gambling. People did it anyway, but that existed out there. And then gradually during the 20th century, both casino gambling and sports gambling became much more part of the mainstream. And I don't think anybody even 2 decades ago could have envisioned this booming as quickly as it has. You know, in 2018, sports bettors were betting about $310 million a month. Now they're betting about $7 billion a month. Companies in this market earn about $1 billion a year in revenue. Wall Street's predicting that in a decade, that'll be $39 billion. So you're talking about massive numbers, and they're massive because gambling is ubiquitous. It's no longer just a brick and mortar casino experience. It's on your phone. It's in people's living rooms. It can be in people's backpacks. It can be on street corners. It can be anywhere you hold a phone. And most people gamble recreationally. At least the historical kind of analysis by public health experts and others is only about 2% of the population develops very, very serious compulsive gambling problems. But that's all based on data from an era in which gambling was confined, particularly sports gambling. So I expect you're going to see people who develop real problems around this skyrocket. The other thing to explore in all this is corruption. There have been all sorts of historical, some of them famous, the 1919 Black Sox scandal, in which gamblers have tried to fix games in order to win money.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another thing that's probably going to come out.
So is this just going to keep growing in this country, despite some of these questions that you're raising? I mean, I read there are measures to open up more gambling in states like California and Texas and North Carolina.
I think there's no doubt it's going to keep going. You know, New York just went online in early January and in 1 month became the biggest market for sports gambling in the country. California has it on the ballot this fall. It is likely, I think, to pass there. And you're also seeing all these partnerships that were once unimaginable. You know, the gambling companies now have direct partnership with sports teams, direct partnerships with professional leagues, and direct partnerships with media companies. You know, if you watch a sports game on TV right now, there are betting lines scrolling across the bottom of the screen like a stock ticker.
Tim O'Brien is a senior columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. You know, as this grows, we're going to have to bring you back. Thank you for the time.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Arlington, Virginia.
And I'm Celeste Headley in Bethesda, Maryland. It's Here and Now.